got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Fulta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here, as always. Kevin, what's going on?
Well, sort of the week from hell. But, you know, other than having a parent in the hospital and computer crash and being in Chicago, everything else is peachy. Oh, man.
Yeah, that's brutal. Well, thoughts and prayers for Kevin, because I'm sure we all know it's very tough to have sick relatives and sick family. So.
Yeah, it was, you know, it's just strange because he went in for one thing and it went just fine. But, you know, anesthesia does funny things, and he had a stroke coming through the surgery. And now, you know, I call up and say, how is he? Says he, they say he's in bed with dyspnea and aphasia. And I said, oh, two nurses. No, it's you got to have humor in a time of crisis. So my dad's not doing great, but things go on. He'd want me to do the podcast. If he knew what a podcast was, he'd want me to do it. So we're going to keep on pushing the science. He was a man of science his whole career, and I'm confident he'll be on the other side of this. So here we go.
Well, in honor of Kevin's dad, let's jump into these stories. So
yeah, let's do it.
First up, why disagreement among religious groups about vaccine mandates. Next, coffee and heart disease. Yet another study finds multiple cups a day reduces death risks. And finally, if evolution encourages reproduction, why do people have same-sex preferences? Fascinating question we'll get into. But first up, Kevin, what's going on? Different religious groups disagreeing over vaccine mandates.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question because it seems to, as we might guess, kind of sort out around political lines more than anything else. And I kind of gave away the punchline of what I'm thinking, but this is in the Washington Post by Michelle Boorstein on September 10th of this year. And she really frames this really as the religious interface of the question of personal freedoms and body integrity versus the obligation to protect health and the lives of others. And that's always kind of the way that I looked at this, was surprised that religious folks would be so opposed to vaccination, because it seems like the masks and all the other things, because it seems like if you did the WWJD math, that maybe you'd want to protect other people and take care of the vulnerable and the weakest among us. And that's kind of the way that the Vatican has been rolling. Their Pontifical Academy for Life, which I never knew there was such a thing. They really feel that there's this moral responsibility to be vaccinated because of the protection it allows you to protect life. You know, the sanctity of life and all that stuff seems kind of consistent. But when you start looking at other groups, especially the more evangelistic groups in the United States anyway, they say things like there's too many unknowns. And that's a quotation from someone from the Radiance Foundation, an evangelical group, easy for me to say, they say there's too many unknowns to really have mandates. So you start looking at this and you really start to get the sense that there's maybe a little touch of hypocrisy, a little dusting of that, but certainly the evidence of some political influence leaking into what potentially should be a scripture-based decision.
Now, one thing I think, this is more of just a general observation, but it seems to me that it was a horrible mistake on everybody's part to tie anything related to vaccination to the abortion debate. Just like, because as soon as you do that, you draw the lines. And as you said, they're political lines, you know? So if you're trying to get more people vaccinated and they happen to be in this kind of conservative milieu, this is the worst possible thing you can say, which is, you know, that issue you really care about. Well, you're a hypocrite, and I'm going to use that issue as the example, because all they're going to do now is dig in their heels and they're going to come up with reasons why they're opposed to you. It's almost like the vaccine becomes incidental in that discussion, because now they're just focused on proving that you're the hypocrite, you know? So now the argument is, well, you're in favor of abortion and bodily autonomy matters then, but it doesn't matter now. And you just have both of these sides slinging mud at each other. And my point here is not to try to settle, you know, the pro-life issue or whatever. That's not the point here. It's just that I think tying this to another political issue was just a terrible mistake.
Yeah, that's really the issue, because they both are taking the my body, my choice angle. And the problem there is that you're looking at two outcomes that are completely different. Abortion is a personal decision that affects that person and the fetus and, you know, maybe a spouse or whatever. The denial to vaccinate could have large community impacts. And so it's really kind of apples and oranges and really not a parallel argument. And it really just adds some more division in what should be a strictly scientific dialogue.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And like I said, you know, you start going down a rabbit trail where you start arguing about the nuances of, okay, well, like basically you have to relitigate the abortion thing in order to settle this dispute that they're having. And I think the broader problem that people should be focusing on is that if, and this is coming from my perspective, because I don't agree with vaccine mandates. I'm fully vaccinated. My kid's getting plugged with every single one of them that the CDC recommends, but I think the vaccines are problematic. And the reason is every argument from bodily autonomy goes out the window, because what you're doing here, and this is, I think, beyond you know, vaccinations for public school attendance. Like, if you're going to tie vaccines to employment, I mean, this potentially really reworks the way our society functions. And it sets a precedent to where the government could intervene in conceivably almost anything that you do if they can come up with a plausible public health justification, you know? So, and maybe you can push back on this, Kevin. I mean, why couldn't the government say, well, there's another pharmaceutical that you are obligated to take in the name of protecting public health, or we have to track your movement because there's a virus going around. So in the name of public health, we need to monitor where everyone is. You see where I'm going with this? It seems like this could potentially, you know, octopus out into all of these different facets of life. And that's the problem, I think, is with this argument.
No, I understand that argument. And it really does get into a gray area for me, but I do see the value in ensuring public health, that if we're all on the same page and all the physicians and the national scientific organizations and the national medical organizations, international medical organizations, we're all in agreement that this is an important public health step to take the vaccine. And so to mandate that, so one side says, yeah, this is important because it's in the interest of insulating public health and the public health system and the crowded ICU rooms and the healthcare worker burnout. We're actually going to help ourselves by forcing the mandate. On the other hand, you can't mandate correct behavior. And when you tell people you must do this or else, it causes more pushback and more to dig in their heels. And this week's Talking Biotech podcast is all about how do we use a softer touch to inspire people to make the right decision and to accept something in the name of public health to elevate all of us. And there's much easier ways through using communication and strategic team building than to implement the divisiveness of a mandate. And so that's kind of where I'm at on this issue.
Let me ask you this, because I'm not sure how I feel about it, but to what extent does the fact that everybody can get vaccinated challenge the validity of a mandate? You know, so like you and I are vaccinated, and I don't know how you feel. I feel pretty confident going out in public and living my life, because the research I've looked at says the vaccines are very effective, even at preventing infection. They're not perfect, and the immunity has definitely waned a little bit post Delta, but they're still very effective. So because I'm able to protect myself and my family like that, does that somehow reduce the necessity of trying to mandate people get these shots?
Well, yes and no. The problem is that the more the virus is allowed to circulate in the unvaccinated population, the more you may develop an immune evasive variant of the virus. And so by allowing it to do what it's doing, it makes it potentially threatening to everybody who already is vaccinated. And so this is the big problem, is that you're giving this thing free range to continue to do what viruses do. And therefore, it does threaten everybody by allowing it to continue to circulate. And when you look across the globe, you know, China, they have incredible compliance on vaccines, and it's not mandated there. The reason you have compliance is because of a heavy-handed government that probably has a lot of very strong communication about doing this for national reasons that we haven't implemented here, and too many people pushing back against it. Meanwhile, they're moving on with things, and we're trying to figure out how we're going to, get to herd immunity. It's really unfortunate, because it's important that people get vaccinated. It has to happen in order to protect the whole, yet we probably will never get there.
Now, to what extent, and we can move on pretty quick, but to what extent does infection-induced immunity come into this? Because it is a thing. I mean, there's more research now showing that if you've been infected, you may have as good or perhaps better in some cases protection than someone who's been vaccinated. So doesn't that alter the equation? Because if you frame it just as vaccines are the only way we can protect people, that doesn't seem to reflect what's actually going on. And I don't want people to get sick, don't get me wrong, but a lot of people have been infected, and as a result, they have some level of immunity against the virus.
Yeah, and that makes sense, because the Israeli study does show that it is probably as good as the vaccine. But as you say, the difference is you have to get sick. You also have to be exposed to a much larger number of antigens than the spike protein which comes in the vaccine. So the chances of complications, the chances of other issues that travel with this virus become much more prevalent. And so it really is a question of, can't we just get this simple, free, safe, effective vaccine that will allow this to not be a problem in the first place? That's where we really have to be. And I'm thinking about this all the time. I'm changing people's minds. It truly is, unfortunately, a challenge because of the politicization. And that's the big issue.
All right. Well, maybe we'll just leave it there, because it's a contentious issue. See, we just never solve big issues on this podcast. We only scratch the surface. something a little less controversial, though. Coffee and heart disease. Kevin, what's up with this study?
Yeah, well, this is another interesting one. And this all comes from, these data that are coming from a database in the UK called the Biobank study. And it's just a large set of data that some people have been mining for information. And this is report on CNN by Sandy Lamont. And the basically says that consumption of 0.5 to 3 cups of coffee a day is associated, and that's the key word, with decreased risk of death from heart disease, stroke, and other causes. And they basically looked at coffee drinking behavior of something like 500,000 people who have been surveyed in the study. And so when you have people self-reporting their data and their habits, you can start to look for statistical associations between things they do, things they don't do, and certain comorbidities. And so they find this association between coffee drinking and a lack of heart disease. And the thing that makes it so much more powerful is that when you look at decaf drinkers, they drop dead all the time. So it just says that they don't show the same protective benefit is what it really showed. And there also are very positive associations between type 2 diabetes, Parkinson's disease, prostate cancer, Alzheimer's, and even computer back pain. So you're too busy reaching to get you're busy getting up now and then to get a cup of coffee. But that's really what it is. These aren't causal associations saying there's something magical in coffee that leads to protective benefit. It says that when you're drinking coffee, you show these other benefits. There's the caveat of some coffee drinkers use creamer and sugar and all kinds of stuff that could have negative effects. So really the protective benefit of coffee could be much higher in reality. So you have to have a lot of, there's many caveats we have to pay attention to when interpreting these kinds of data.
So to what extent, and forgive me for sounding cynical, but to what extent do we need more studies like this? Because there's probably been, I don't want to say it's thousands, it's probably in the hundreds of these different kind of epidemiological studies showing that coffee reduces your risk of heart disease, or it makes you an inch and a half taller, or whatever. Or, and they always qualify it, you know, this isn't causal, but the implication is this is causal. This is why, you know, this is why outlets like CNN like reporting on this. You know, it's because people go, oh, good, you know, I can slam my latte or whatever. So yeah. In other words, like, what value do we get out of doing more studies like this?
And I think that's really the big issue, right? But I think when you start taking all these things together and you build meta-analyses where you're combining them and you're doing it in a meaningful and statistically powerful way, then maybe there's a little additional power that can actually give you some sort of answer. And my guess is that when you put them all in the blender, they regress to the mean and there's no benefit, you know, ultimately. That's just a guess, but maybe that's where something can come from. The other important thing on this particular one is that when you talk about a cup of coffee, they're saying 8 ounces. And 8 ounces, for those of you who are listening overseas, is like a thimbleful. I mean, it's almost none. And it's, I don't know, what would that be? A half a pint? Yeah, 8 ounces is half a pint. So half a pint of coffee, a cup of coffee is 8 ounces. Yeah, half a pint. So it's very, very little coffee. And, you know, so usually we go get, you know, fill up that giant coffee cup. It's usually 20 ounces. And so a cup of coffee for me is quite a bit. So anyway, there's a lot of other little caveats and edges to these studies that, you know, we do have to take into consideration before we interpret them and run out for a giant cup of a coffee.
So what you're saying is I can't celebrate the fact that I drink 2 16 ounce rock stars in the morning. I can't say, well, you know, science shows it's good for my heart.
Now, the only thing that I think is the positive correlation with coffee is sex. And that, I think that one's been pretty sure because, well, coffee keeps you awake. And the more awake you are, the more likely you are to have sex. That's like, I think that's the only real causal one that you could draw. I think, you know, but that is one that I've seen that I think there really is some sort of causal association that you can believe. So there you go.
Well, that's true, but perhaps on a slightly more serious note, I've seen studies where they say people who drive truck cross country, they sustain themselves on caffeine, you know, because they're on the road for 8 or 10 hours at a time. And if one of those goes off the road, that's potentially very, very dangerous. Not that a regular car crash isn't, but, you know, it's like if you're driving an 18-wheeler or something. So there are some benefits. I'm just thinking in a broader public health sense. When you have people chain smoking alongside their coffee, you know, the coffee's not offsetting the risk they're incurring.
Yeah, probably not. But, you know, there are kinds of interesting weirdnesses in coffee, all these polyphenols and other health related compounds that, you know, or I shouldn't say that have been implicated in health, you know, trace compounds that are been assumed to have some sort of potential effects. So, you know, the jury's out. You would think that if there really was something, they would have figured it out by now. Purified it, stuck it in a capsule and said, here, you never get another heart ailment. But these are just, you know, association studies. We take them for what they're worth and that's it. So maybe that's the take home message from this part is, you know, you have to think carefully about the data as you interpret them.
Yeah. Yeah. You're probably just better off living life and not freaking out about whether coffee is going to kill you or save your life.
That's right.
Okay. Evolution and same-sex preferences. Tell us about the study.
Yeah, this is kind of cool. And this was by Brendan Zeitz, who is a professor at Queensland University in Australia, down under. And he was talking about, and this is, an association study using the UK Biobank data. And so same as the coffee study, they used the same set of reports. And what it really said was, and what they looked for was, in same-sex couples, what things are the same, and also looking at genetic variables, and in heterosexual couples, what are some genetic variables? And what they've been looking at are actual genetic data that show genetic variants that you can account for some level of the variability. So in other words, there's certain genetic variants that associate with homosexuality versus heterosexuality. The reason this is important is because we asked the question, well, if homosexuality was favored in a population, how would it be retained? Because you wouldn't be passing on the genes to your offspring, who would then propagate those and perpetuate them. They wouldn't have a selective advantage towards reproduction because that relationship is a reproductive dead end. And at least in terms of passing on those gametes or those, you know, sex genes. And so there never has been much support for the idea of a gay gene, as they've called it. But what the Zeitz study shows is that there are many different biomarkers that may account for partial contributions, and that these partial contributions that may contribute between 8 to 25% of may account for 8 to 25% of the genetic variability associated with homosexuality. And so these may travel with other important selective advantage traits. And so that is why this appears to be a valid study that suggests that there is a strong genetic component that suggests there's something to do with same-sex couples.
So help me understand this. I think this is the concept of pleiotropy. Is that how you pronounce it? Where you have a single gene that can have multiple impacts. And so you have a lot of genes that fall into this category. And so one thing they do is they help heterosexual people survive and thrive and reproduce. But then in another part of the population, they encourage or they may influence homosexual behavior. Is that the gist of it? Am I on the right track with that?
Yeah, I think that's what they're calling, what they're suggesting is okay. That these are traits that cause you to have attractions to different people. And in one context, it's one way, in another context, it's another. And it's all suggesting that these are genes that all impart a slight influence. And when you start looking at multiple genes affecting a given set of traits, there's many or given behavior, which really is complicated to tie behavior to specific genetic traits, but these associations are very real and statistically relevant, that there are other influences and overlays that also influence those genes that can maybe take them homosexual or heterosexual, same sex or the non-same sex. And, you know, I think that makes perfect sense. And we've seen it for years in other organisms. There's genes in fruit flies that can, no pun intended, that can allow them to be mating within sex, you know. And so those of us in science who understand genetics never saw homosexuality as something that was terribly hard to understand from a genetic side. It makes total sense. These data really just support that there are genetic variants that probably help explain it.
So what sort of studies would they have to do to flesh this out? Because this is more or less just a really big statistical association, right? Like they don't know why these genes have the particular influences they do, right? What would be the next step to validate what they found here?
Well, it's really difficult to do those kinds of studies ethically in human beings, right? Because you can't, take an embryo like the dude did in China and gene edit it to edit out all of the genes associated with, or, you know, that had positive associations with heterosexuality and see if the offspring are homosexual. You know, we just don't do those kinds of experiments. So really you fall back on large scale statistical studies where you start to look at a prevalence of different alleles or different gene variants in populations and their associations in specific population groups. And just as you could start to say, these are the variants we see associated with sickle cell disease, you could look at these are the associations we see with homosexuality. Not that it's a disease, but it's a set of genes that together are associated with specific behaviors. And I think that's probably the best that you could ever do here.
Very good. All right. Well, I don't think we settled this one either.
Well, thank goodness, because I do think it's nice that we, you know, further develop the idea that this is a normal variation in human beings. And, you know, all the years that people, you know, looked at this as some sort of aberrant behavior, go out the window, that this is probably something that's always been with us and always will be with us. And it just is a natural variation in humans. And I think there's something very nice about that.
Very good. All right, Kevin, who are you following on Twitter these days?
This week, we got to do something a little different. And I hope you oblige me to just promote the hashtag science hug. Because here's the deal. You know, we're living in a world of madness and people are angry and every, you know, social media has turned into a total sewer. The way we have political discussions, the way we have personal discussions, road rage, you name it. And around vaccination, it's been just so contentious and angry. And I'm finding a great ability to change people's hearts and minds by just being kind and really piling it on. I've been always this way anyway in the last 10 years. But I'm finding that if we can change the dialogue to one where we really are actively engaging people with high road, empathy-driven, values-based discussions, I think we can change things. And I really want everyone to do the experiment. Engage the GMO discussion. Engage the vaccine discussion. Go to hashtag GMO this week. And when you see something crazy, answer it kindly. And hashtag science hug. Let's see if we can flip this thing.
Yeah. See, I was just going to say I wholeheartedly endorse that. And interestingly, the follow I'm going to recommend this week, his name's Dave Smith. He's a comedian and a political commentator, but he talks on the podcast he does. It's called Part of the Problem. He talks a lot about how you change someone's mind about a political issue. And one of the points he always makes, and I think I've said this on the show and I'm going to have to give him credit now, is he says, don't threaten people's identity when you're trying to change their mind. And that's what I was getting at earlier when we were talking about abortion and vaccines. It's like, if you know that there's people that are deeply passionate about that, don't poke them in the face with that as your poker. That's just dumb. So that's one reason I like the stuff that he talks about. So even if you don't agree with everything he says, and I promise you won't, because he's very adamantly against a vaccine mandate, for example. But I think there's something you can learn from people who are aware of the fact that they need to speak to people where they are. So his handle is @comicDaveSmith. And I think, nice. I think you guys will benefit from that. That's what we're all here to do, is benefit and learn stuff. So we'll leave it there, but you can follow us as well. Kevin is @KevinFolza on Twitter, and you can follow me @ACSH.org and my website, CameronJEnglish.net. Let's see. We're on Spotify. We're on iTunes, geneticliteracyproject.org. Thank you guys so much. We will see you next week.